from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Twitter's IPO is scheduled for Thursday. The company just boosted the price range, the price per share they're looking for. But no matter what, we're talking about an operation likely to be valued at many billions of dollars. Where does that value come from? How do you peg the worth of tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions, exchanging 140-character tweets? Twitter is already making changes in the way it works. For many users, it is their internet nerve system, always on, always out there. This hour, On Point, Twitter's IPO and where Twitter takes us. You can join us on air or online where this conversation's always on. Are you on Twitter? Do you tweet? What's it do for you? Is it worth billions? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. 140 characters and an awful lot of those and fewer flying around the internet universe these days. Here's a little tape of one of the co-founders of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, describing the origins and value as he sees it in an interview here with Corporate Valley in March of this year. He said it all began, Twitter, with a simple idea.
What if I could be anywhere and share what's happening? And I could also get everything in real time. I met my co-founders, Biz Stone and Evan Williams, who had worked to build Blogger, so they understood the importance of self-publishing. And I just added this real-time aspect. What if, with just SMS on the web, I can go anywhere I want and report what I'm doing and then see what everyone else is doing in real time? Very, very simple start. And the users have taken it from there.
Microblogging taken to the world and now taken to the public markets. We're going to look at the value proposition here and also where this wing of social media is taking our kind of shared consciousness in this hour. Joining us from New York City is Zach Seward, senior editor of Atlantic Media's online business news magazine, Quartz. Zach Seward, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from New York is Rob Armstrong, head of Lex, the Financial Times opinion and analysis column. He's been watching every angle of the Twitter IPO. Rob Armstrong, welcome to you as well.
It's a pleasure.
Rob, give us the timetable here. When does this march out? What's happening in terms of just taking this thing public, the mechanics?
Well, we just saw the price range get released and increased, and that gives potential buyers of the offering a sense of what they're going to pay, and we'll get a final pricing tomorrow night, I believe.
And just mechanically, is this out there, or will it be out there for anybody to buy, or is it already
Thursday morning?
You can start speculating on
Twitter.
Okay.
Well, the way IPOs work is that institutional buyers who have relationships to the brokers who are running the offering will take the offering in its entirety, but many of them will turn around and immediately sell some part of the stakes that they've bought. So almost immediately you'll be able to bid using your brokerage account on Fidelity or Schwab.
So this is Goldman Sachs birthing this thing as the investment bank. And what's the range Twitter is now saying they're looking for an opening price?
Isn't it 20 to 24 now?
I think it's higher than that. I mean, we're talking about—
Do they knock it up one?
$23 to $25
a share. $23 to $25, which, Zach, that would mean what? North of $13 billion if they hit the higher end of that, given the number of shares they're selling.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they sell the maximum number of shares that they could, then that would make the IPO larger than Google's in terms of the amount of money raised. Still far smaller than Facebook's, but that would be the second largest internet IPO in history by most measures.
And you also need to remember
that
the brokers who are running this offering are going to design it, price it, so that they can get a price pop upon the open of trading of, some 20%. So if it goes as they plan, you're talking about a $28 stock here on Thursday morning, and that gets you to almost $18 billion of value for the company.
Lots of fortunes made. Of course, for most people, this is just vicarious talking about that angle because, of course, most people have no stake in this, but some big money will be made. What's the buzz around this, Rob? Is when you say it's going to be bigger than Google's, does that make sense to people? Twitter with a bigger IPO than Google's?
Well, remember, there's two issues here. There's the total value of the company and the total value of the shares that got sold.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So neither company, neither in Google's case nor in Twitter's case, is the whole company being sold to the public, only a small slice of it. Mm-hmm. So the all the actual size of the offering tells you is the depth of demand. It doesn't it's not a direct indicator of the value of the company. But you know, Twitter is coming to market at a very fortunate time. The stock market is red hot right now, and so demand for any offering is going to be good, and demand for a company that is actually growing its revenues is going to be particularly hot. So,
though still losing money hand over fist.
Well, it depends how you measure it. I would say it's losing money. It's no longer losing money hand over fist, which is enough in an environment like the one we find ourselves in.
I mean, I'm looking here. This is from CNET. Twitter lost $132 million on $422 million in revenue during the first 9 months of the year. That's not exactly in the black.
No, it is not. However, there's always a way that Wall Street can measure a company to find it profitable. So the number that people are going to be looking at on the Wall Street side is the amount the company is earning before stock compensation for its employees, before interest expense, before depreciation and amortization, if you're a finance geek. And so you take all these unpleasant negatives out and you eventually get to a positive number.
Zach Seward, take us on in here. What's the fundamental value proposition of Twitter?
If you're an investor or you're considering investing in the IPO, I think you have to be you're fundamentally betting that Twitter can put more ads in more places, right? They just in the last 2 years built up an advertising business out of nothing, and it's really impressive growth. But the open question, and I really do think it's an open question, is how much more room is there to fit in more and more ads? So Twitter has a fairly novel advertising product. It's essentially the same kind of tweets you see from your friends and other organizations and people that you follow, except the company paid to have that tweet show up in your timeline. That's a great advertising product, it seems, and companies seem willing to pay for it. But there's got to be a limit on how many of those Twitter can show. Facebook, for instance, last week said it thinks it probably has hit its own limit in terms of the number of ads it can stuff into Facebook news feeds. Twitter is not near that limit, but there's got to be one. And if you're an investor, there's a big question there because as an investor, you're obviously betting on future growth, but the amount of future growth is unknown. I should say, of course, the other big factor would be how much user growth, how many users Twitter can continue to add. It's seen pretty good growth. It's about at 230 million monthly active users. That is people who log in at least once a month. But in the U.S., that growth has started to slow. And they're hardly saturating the U.S. market at this point. So there's plenty of room to grow in the U.S. if they can. But the slowing growth is a troubling sign.
I mean, it's not as easy to understand as Facebook for a lot of people. You go on Twitter and it's not necessarily intuitive what's happening there. What about the user value model here, Zach? I mean, you're talking about a revenue model for users. What has this come to be? I mean, we know people pile in. They follow people here. What, Katy Perry just bumped Justin Bieber out of first place. She's got 46.5 million followers here. What's the primary use that's emerged of Twitter, Zach?
I think it appeals to certain people who like to be hooked up intravenously to the web, news junkies, those who like their information in real time and don't mind the messiness that is a Twitter timeline. You're absolutely right. It's much harder to understand that intuitively than a Facebook news feed. And so it appeals to a different and it seems smaller demographic. Twitter wants to make the service simpler. Just last night, it unveiled new about pages to try to explain what's a tweet, how does this whole thing work.
Right.
It's been working on that first day experience when you first sign up for Twitter. I mean, what do you do?
Right.
It's a big
You're not
question.
Following anybody. Nobody follows you. You're kind of in an echo chamber.
One thing that works tremendously to Twitter's advantage here is that the kind of people who Zach just described, people who want to be speaking to and hearing from people around the internet in a continuous way. Two of those groups of people are journalists and Wall Street types.
Yes.
This makes it much easier for them to sell their shares, because the people who are talking about them in the media and the people who are thinking about buying them are probably on Twitter.
Okay, let's talk about another echo chamber right there. But there aren't 230 million of those journalists and Wall Street types.
No, but they're particularly important to Twitter's future.
And they've got a lot of activity going on right now. Everybody watching this IPO, we're interested in that. Some people are going to make a lot of money here. There's a whole competition between Google and Facebook and Pinterest and Instagram and Twitter. We're also going to look at the way that Twitter is changing the way we interact with the internet. Zach Seward calls it the intravenous feed. Zach Seward, please stand by at Quartz. Rob Armstrong at Lex, the Financial Times opinion and analysis column. Listeners, you can join us. We're looking at Twitter's big IPO. Katy Perry behind us. She's number one right now in followers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Twitter's big IPO and the value of an empire of tweets, where Twitter takes us. Zach Seward is with us, senior editor of Atlantic Media's online business news magazine, Quartz. He's looking at all of this. Rob Armstrong is here from Lex, the Financial Times opinion and analysis column. 140 characters, pop it out there anytime. Millions and millions of people doing that, a kind of real-time snapshot of what people are talking about, chatting about, thinking about on the web. Here's some of the founders again from the IPO Video Roadshow. Founders Jack Dorsey, Evan Williams, Biz Stone talking about what makes Twitter successful, what people have accomplished with it.
We loved it, and we kept building it because we wanted to see other people use it.
We just never thought it would go this way, and I honestly think that's part of the reason why we succeeded. It's such a simple tool, yet people have done so many amazing things with it.
Okay, they're selling right there, selling like crazy lately because they're going public. We get it. But it is all over the place. People talking about it, thinking about it, obsessed by it. Here from the fifth season of the NBC show Parks and Recreation, Tom Haverford, played by Aziz Ansari, is in court for crashing his car when the prosecutor asks him about the circumstances of the accident.
And you were texting at the time, correct?
How dare you, sir? I was tweeting.
Please read Exhibit C, the transcript of your Twitter page leading up to and immediately following your crash.
9:15, four green lights in a row. Hashtag blessed. 9:17, drive faster, Blue Civic. Damn. Hashtag soccer moms. 9:18, gotta pass this lady on the edge. That's when I hit the fire hydrant. Sorry, allegedly hit the fire hydrant.
Okay, it's not all joy on Twitter. You're tweeting while you're driving and you're into the fire hydrant right there on Parks and Recreation. Zach, it's funny. I mean, and Rob, we've got all kinds of, this is just the way it works now. We're talking about Twitter. We've got people tweeting about our conversation about Twitter. You know, you can on and on and on, the sort of hall of mirrors here. And everybody wants to let people know what they're doing. Zach, here's your tweet. I see, you know, I'll be on Point Radio. Here's your buddy's tweet. Matt says, you know, Z Seward bringing his A game to On Point Radio, and here we are doing it. Casey says, I'm on Twitter while listening to at On Point Radio talk about Twitter. So, Meta, let's hear from our listeners. While we've got all the tweeting going on, let's talk to Sheila, Stillwater, Oklahoma. What do you think of Twitter, Sheila?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When I first started, I was a bit unsure about how to get followers and who to follow. But now that I've been doing it about a year, my favorite way to use it is to use it as a search engine. So when there's a breaking story, you just search for the keywords and you can see all the relevant tweets. And so when the Boston bombing happened, I was in an airport and was able to actually just read the tweets from people who were in Watertown, Massachusetts.
It can be pretty amazing in that way. It's true. And so immediate. How many people do you follow at this point, Sheila? Or is that not your style?
Well, it's quite addictive, I have to say. I have about I follow 9,000 people, and oh. I'm being followed now by 8,000 people, and I don't know any of them. Personally.
but they're your followers. And what do you tweet when you tweet? Do you put news up there or, you know, I'm having oatmeal? Or is that news?
Well, I tweet NPR stories and I tweet news stories that are related to my interests. And I find that the followers, you follow people who have similar interests to you. And we also tweet pictures of our pets.
Of course, the full range. Sheila in Stillwater, Oklahoma, I appreciate your call. I mean, Rob, let me put it to you. What do you tweet about? What do you follow? How do you use it?
I'm what's referred to, for the most part, on Twitter as a lurker.
Lurker, meaning you follow and watch and read.
I follow and listen and read more than I tweet myself, which is a very irresponsible pattern of behavior for a journalist who's supposed to be self-promoting. But, you know, there when you have professional interests that kind of span across business and finance, it's great. You get, you know, Robert Shiller – you know, tweeting the guy who just won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, sure.
You get people you know are traders on Wall Street who are tweeting anonymously what they're up to. It's just – it's like for a journalist, it's an idea generation tool. You know, you only get 140 characters, but in so many cases, it's just enough to make you say, huh, what do I think of that? How can we move that story forward? So – it's something that allows you to initiate a process, you know, and it, no more than that, and it doesn't have to be any more than that.
Zach, how do you use it? What do you read? What do you tweet?
These days, it's pretty meta. I've been covering the IPO, so everything I tweet about is Twitter.
Right.
But you know, both the coverage areas that I'm focused on, and interests. But I guess it's distinct from Facebook, where you know you might be using that to talk with friends, to share photos, much more about your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
With Twitter, and I think because it's public and like Sheila said, you're talking to people you mostly actually don't know or aren't friends with. You're talking much more either professionally or just about interests, TV shows, that sort of thing. It's less about your private lives.
So I'm reading here from Twitter, as we talk, as we tweet, Bernard says, is quoting a study, I don't know, it says, half of U.S. adult Twitter users make it their primary news feed. That's from Reuters. You know, and I'm learning this 1 minute after he saw it, and he puts it straight up there. Ray in Vermont writes to us online, says, regardless of Twitter as a business enterprise, I do find it very interesting as a platform. My wife checks it to see what her favorite comedians are up to, and it's interesting to see them interacting with their followers online in a public forum. Yeah, unlike Facebook, I mean, everything here is public. Mary in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. One thing that's not been in this discussion yet is the people who use Twitter for some very serious discussions.
Like what?
For example, well, scientists, for example. There's a well-known blogger, Deanne Lee, who blogs for Scientific American, and she will often tweet in the middle of an experiment asking her colleagues for input for techniques, tricks that they have that will make things go better.
So maybe it's her eureka moment, or maybe help me, I'm stuck, and does she get quick feedback?
Absolutely, she gets quick feedback, often from multiple people.
I mean, this is really interesting to me. So there you are, Zach. Mary, thank you for that. Zach, there you are, right in the middle of scientific experimentation. You know, the old line was that the internet would become the global nervous system. Maybe in a way, this is becoming that kind of platform, Zach. You know, help, I'm stuck in my experiment. It's boiling over. What do I do? And bing, 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 you get tweets back from friends, colleagues, scientists around the world saying, try this.
I think it's clear Twitter has that potential, and its challenge is making sure everyone has as good an experience with it as Mary, right? It's not particularly easy to set up and find that community. You can essentially assume there's a community of people talking about whatever subject you're interested in, however narrow, and that's the huge potential of it. But finding that community isn't always easy. For journalists, maybe it's, you know, they're all out there. You can find them all, and they're pretty chatty. But for a very narrow scientific issue, I'm sure they're out there too. And the question is just looking them up.
Right? And I think it's also worthwhile. What is so great about Twitter is that it is a frictionless communication tool. It is the chat rooms that we were in 15 years ago, mm-hmm. but much more intelligently designed, much easier to customize and to use for specific purposes. But that frictionlessness is the challenge for Twitter as a business and as an investment.
Why is that a challenge?
The job of Twitter's management now is to create friction in Twitter, the kind of friction that causes people to send them money.
Oh, you're saying they're going to throw ads, throw some sand in the gears here.
So there's going to be ads. And, you know, the commercialization of this probably won't end at advertising, right?
What else?
Some kind of premium product for businesses or power users or something. The point is, if you're going to sell this business for $18 billion, right, there's got to be an ever-enlarging pile of revenues here. So you're taking that message board, which has a kind of everybody's in it together, join hands and sing kumbaya feeling to it, and turn it into a proper business that can last a long time.
I mean, it's already become more annoying, Zach. When you go now, when I go on at the top, you know, there's going to be several ads stacked up there. And now with Twitter, just over the last few days, making photographs and images much bigger, they pop up right away, not just the text. Some of those can be really in your face. I mean, there can be great images too, and it's more visually exciting to follow. But they have already pumped up the volume of the ad presence here, Zach.
Yeah, the company says that displaying images by default is for users and makes a better user experience. But, I mean, you know, it's hard. You have to suspect that when you look at them and especially see these huge ads, that it's really to create a better ad product. And in that sense, you know, the IPO is a way for Twitter's investors to realize gains on their investments, for its early employees to be rewarded for their work, a few other reasons you might go public. But it's also, I think, if you're a user, a sad moment. There's a decent argument to be made that Twitter's most interesting period is now behind it. It is an amazing success story. They created a really interesting service. And as Rob said, now they have to start making much more money from it. And that arguably is much less interesting. It's obviously the obligation of a public company. It's exactly what they need to be doing. But it doesn't mean it's going to be any better for us users.
All kinds of reaction to it here. Kyle on Facebook says, hashtag useless. Sarah says, hashtag major time sink. Hashtag my first hashtag ever. And Niaga writes to us, hashtag overrated, narcissistic, obnoxious. Three of the hashtags I'd use to describe Twitter.
Is that talking about me specifically?
Yeah, I don't know if it's you or Zach or me or just the whole thing. I mean, I understand how people have that impression. But then, you know, I did myself for a while, and now it has become a useful tool for just keeping up with people who I know are going to be tweeting out the very latest on the news and very, very quickly. TL in Edinburgh, Virginia. TL, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Point was exactly what I was going to say. We get the information out there so quickly these days that a lot of it is misinformation. And the idea seems to be, let's get it out there first and correct it later if we have to. And I think a lot of that's just not responsible journalism, number one. And then people are going off half-cocked with information that they think they have.
Yeah.
And it's this instant gratification society, and I think Twitter is the top of the heap of what's wrong with our society in that kind of a way. Everything's got to be right now and worry about whether it's right later.
Well, I mean, things can cut two ways, more than two ways. TL, I take your point. You've got to be careful here. What about the self-policing of this over time, Zach? Has this become, you know, a fountain of instant misinformation, or do you look at it as generally useful? Is it half-cocked rubbish, or do you curate your own, I don't know, the people you follow in such a way that you've got a pretty good sense of credibility there, Zach?
Well, all due respect to the caller, it's a bit like criticizing the Telegraph in an earlier era rather than the person using the Telegraph to send that misinformation. And she's not wrong about, obviously, a greater and greater demand for faster and faster information. But, you know, whether Twitter is the problem there or merely the conduit is debatable. But look, I mean, the other day, shots fired at LAX.
Yep.
Twitter was where I learned about that first, and a good 10 minutes before the cable networks even tuned away from whatever else they were talking about to focus on the story. And I'm sure there was misinformation there, as there always is. But to be honest, I felt better informed by following my Twitter feed than I did by following cable news.
I mean, Rob, there's a new way of getting information here. This comes so quickly that the very first thing you read may be incomplete, could even be wrong. Sort of like when you stub your toe in the dark, you don't know what it is right away, but you know that something's there. there's a kind of evolutionary process with Twitter. And from, you know, you learn, you get a heads up here and then you fill in the blanks or refine as you go. Maybe a new way of reading. This isn't copy edited and, you know, poured over all night and then put on your doorstep in the morning.
Right. And I think as users, we're going to have a process of learning how to distinguish the signal from the noise in Twitter. And there's a lot of noise. The caller is dead right. There's a lot of nonsense there. And it requires some intelligence on the part of the reader. But at, you know, what the cable network or the FT or Quartz does and what Twitter does is different. When we go to what we call going to press, which is not a press anymore, you know, we put our authority behind it and we add some value that way. Twitter is a kind of early signaling system, a warning system. But, you know, to turn this conversation slightly back to the IPO, you know, I would say the kind of issues we've been discussing here in the last minute or two have direct implications for the business case
for
Twitter. Because advertisers are just learning about what this is in the same way that users are just learning about what this is. And the kind of things they're just learning about is what sort of risks are you taking with your brands when you put them up in a Twitter feed? What is your brand? What are your brands going to be right up next to in people's Twitter feeds? So right now, the kind of advertising that Twitter is trying to do is working quite well, specifically on Facebook. Facebook is putting up some astonishing numbers in its quarterly results the last couple of quarters. But it's early days. The honeymoon is not yet over. There's going to come a time a couple of years from now when, say, Procter & Gamble, who spends many billions of dollars on advertising, will now have experience with Facebook and Twitter. And maybe they'll reconsider. Maybe they'll love it. Maybe they won't. We just don't know in these early days.
And what about Zach's observation that this is a sad moment because as of the moment of the IPO, Twitter will have to put all of its focus on pumping up those numbers and whatever that takes in terms of the user experience?
Well, as an observer, for me, this is when it gets fun. The user experience is probably going to get worse. I don't see how it gets better.
More ads,
but
crowding
more
in.
More ads and more, you know, and maybe they try to make me pay for something down the road. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be fun to watch how this thing unfolds.
What are you projecting here? Facebook had that huge run-up in the IPO and then boom, off a cliff. How's Twitter positioned?
Well, it ain't worth $24, I'll tell you that. But it's going to get $24 and there's going to be a run-up after the IPO. There's a lot of reasons having nothing to do with the company's fundamental value that I think are going to support this stock, the most important of which is simply that we're an overheated stock market. And an offering like this is going to do well regardless of the fundamentals.
Rob Armstrong, it's been great to have you with us from Lex. It's the Financial Times opinion and analysis column. We'll be watching along with you as it comes out. Rob, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Zach Seward, please stand by there at Quartz. Here's some old school tweets for you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
He rocks in the treetop all the day long, hopping and hopping and singing his song. All the little birds on Jaybird Street talk to hear the robin go tweet, tweet, tweet. Rockin' Robin. Tweet, tweet. Rockin' Robin. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Blow Rockin' Robin, cause we're really gonna rock tonight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Twitter's big IPO and the value of an empire of tweets. Zach Seward is with us from Quartz, joins us from New York City. Jennifer Van Grove at CNET joins us in just a moment. Zach, interesting, all kinds of responses here. You know, Hap says, I think the popularity of Twitter is a fad, but once the fad is over, there'll still be a place for Twitter as an info buffet. John says, as a management professor, I see Twitter as a vital learning turbocharger for business students. It's a funnel for your brain where you can pour in continuous insight. Beth says, this is on Facebook, talking about Twitter. I find it valuable for fun, friendship, news, music, poetry, interactions with people I may not know otherwise. Nick's calling from Nashville. Nick, you're on the air with Zach Seward. What do you think of Twitter?
Hi, Tom. Well, I work here in Nashville for a major record label, help run the Twitter account for that label and several artists here. And what we've really seen is that we've really seen the artist-fan relationship really get turned on its end by Twitter, because fans now have an almost, you know, very close one-way connection to the artist. And you know, when they get a retweet or a reply from them, it's really personal. And you know, we've never seen that kind of technology happen, even with Facebook before.
This is not a bundle of fan letters. This is a direct interaction. What portion of your musicians actually do the tweeting, or do they have someone they've hired to do it for them?
You know what? It's about 90%. And this is one of the only facets of our business where in digital, where the artist actually participates so much, and the fans can see that, and the authenticity in the tweets, you know, shows itself. And you know, we have artists that will, you know, sometimes tweet out, you know, when they're in a town that says, "Hey, meet me at this restaurant," and you know, the next 10 people that show up, I'll buy you lunch.
So, we've seen that with sports figures and others. Boom, they show up. What about beyond fan interaction? That is a pretty cool new thing. How one person can interact with so many and in real time. Beyond that, what's the coolest thing you've seen, Nick, on Twitter?
You know, why I initially called was because I was going to actually talk about Egypt. And the coolest thing I've ever seen on Twitter was how when the government first toppled in Egypt and they cut communications off everywhere, people still had Twitter, and they organized via Twitter, and they had rallies via Twitter, and that kind of kept the revolution going. And I think that's a really incredible thing for democracy there.
Tahrir Square got a lot of attention, a lot of workout right there. Nick, I appreciate your call very much. A couple more here. Mark in Akron, Ohio. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention that I actually have two uses of Twitter, and professionally I use it in the classroom. All my college courses have Twitter feeds, separate Twitter feeds for each course, and I use it to keep in touch with students. So I'll update them about class assignments, or there's a quiz coming up, remind them about reading to do.
Yeah.
And so I find that is my primary use.
So when you look at the value of this thing, does it look valuable to you? It's got its IPO this week. Would you put money into it?
I think the IPO is a little high, but I also think that they have not tapped these sorts of markets as an academic market, a business market. I mean, it's difficult for me to set up the Twitter feeds. Well, not difficult, but I have to have a separate email account for every one of these feeds. So I've got 7 or 8 different emails. But if Twitter came along and said to me, as a university, came along and said, look, we can auto-populate your students in here. You can have a separate feed. You can contact them. I think that's a whole market they haven't even explored yet.
Mark in Akron, that sounds like good advice. Twitter, listen up. You've got users ready for more applications. Mark, good luck. I appreciate your call. One more, Muhammad in Boston. Muhammad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a simple prediction. As I'm listening to people talk about Twitter and you know, the financial gains that it's expected to make, I predict that Twitter will be beating Google at its own game. Not only Google, but also those you know, scholarly databases like you know, EBSCOhost and LexisNexis and what have you. I think that if people would tailor the Twitter feeds just to follow people who write and pontificate about their own interests, I predict that it will make you know, their search, students or people who are in the master's or the PhD programs, they'll make their search that much quicker and that much easier, because if you were to put a search keyword into Google, it just gives you millions of links, and you have to spend the time and to sort through them. But if you set the parameters for Twitter, it will definitely get you just the exact things that you need by following people who have written about the subject of interest to you. I have written, I mean, my interest is in immigration policies, and the people that I follow are people who have written about immigration policies, and that's why I find it to be, you know, a lot, you know, user-friendly and less time-consuming.
Fascinating. So a better search experience than Google for you, the way you use Twitter, that's kind of incredible. Who would have thought that it would become a kind of search engine, and yet there's so much up there. I get it. One more. Caitlin in Boston. Caitlin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I just wanted to bring kind of an unusual aspect to the conversation. I run anonymous Twitter accounts, which means that they have no connection to my name, my address, my personal information.
Why do you do it? What for?
Well, I started running mine just because I didn't want my school to find it.
Okay.
But I have friends that have since turned entire accounts into businesses. One of the most recent ones that's done extremely well is called Proper Kid Problems. And he's taken his Twitter handle and turned it into a separate blog and now a whole company that sells its own merchandise and pairs with other big brands.
So I don't get it. How does he make money?
Just from tweeting from his account, posting pictures from his account of things that he finds attractive.
So companies pay him for endorsements in a way?
Sort of, but he also has his own merchandise. He makes, you know, bow ties, bracelets.
Another company
makes boat shoes.
Right.
It's kind of really insane, but I know of at least 10 different Twitter accounts that have companies with their own merchandise.
We got everything going on out there. Caitlin, we've got it. You're telling us it's way beyond just advertising. Zach Stewart, I guess what we're hearing is there's a lot of room for evolution here.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of the CBS sitcom Blank My Dad Said, which evolved from a Twitter account where a guy was just sharing quotes from his sort of cranky father. You know, in its IPO filing, Twitter argues that the web has gone through several stages. There were web portals like Yahoo and then search engines like Google and then social media like Facebook. And Twitter argues that it embodies a new era, not social media, but something quite different that's much more public and real time. It's interesting, actually, that the Twitter rejects the social media label. It's trying – a bit of it's marketing, of course, but they're trying to position themselves as the next era of the web. Which is interesting, too, because, of course, it started as a text messaging service.
Yeah.
That's why it's 140-character limit, because the text is limited to 160.
Do they have a name for that next era that they'd like to see themselves as the pioneer of?
Not a succinct one quite yet. They say public, real-time, conversational, and distributed.
They'll need something shorter than that for a hashtag. Hashtags, I want to talk about that. Twitter really made them into a big social phenom. Last month or September, here was Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon performing a skit on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, imagining a Twitter conversation in person, including hashtags.
Hey, check it out. I brought you some cookies. Hashtag homemade, hashtag oatmeal raisin, hashtag show me the cookie.
Sweet. Hashtag don't mind if I don't. Pretty good. Hashtag getting my cookie on. Hashtag I'm the real cookie monster. Hashtag no, 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 no.
Delicious, right? Yeah. Hashtag I did it all for the cookie. Hashtag LOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLOLO
Jennifer Van Grove joins us right now from San Diego, covers social media for the technology website CNET. Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. It's nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you. I mean, you really can't talk about Twitter without talking about this hashtag phenom. They introduced it, I guess. It had a kind of precursor, but for most of the public, Twitter brought it to us. Now people putting sort of, you know, tags and meta tags on everything on Twitter and out in the rest of life. What's the phenom here, Jennifer?
Well, currently people are using it as a slang, so, you know, it's a very easy way to kind of speak Twitter or Instagram, where hashtags are also extremely popular. But when they were first created in 2007, it was created by a user called Chris Messina. He was borrowing the concept from IRC, and it was more of an idea to, you know, link yourself to topics so that you could have conversations on Twitter. It was very hard to have conversations. Twitter didn't actually support them in terms of hyperlinking them until 2009. So it was a feature invented by a user that just kind of blew up in terms of popularity. Initially, it was just geeks using it. And as you've seen recently, everybody from, Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake are on the hashtag bandwagon.
So just walk through carefully here for people who don't use Twitter, because not everybody does. How's the hashtag work? What, within the Twitter context, we know it's leaked out and it's become bigger than that, but within Twitter, what, if I want to look for tweets about a particular subject, people will have dropped this hashtag, whatever it is, Red Sox or Tahrir Square, whatever it is, into their tweet?
Right. So a very easy way to talk about any sort of particular topic, be it, you know, some breaking news event or pop culture or even a TV show. So most people who watch TVs have seen different shows use a particular hashtag to get people to talk around a specific subject. You use the pound sign, you use the hashtag. then that hashtag becomes clickable, and you can see search results that are just mentioning conversations with that particular hashtag.
And then the leak from Twitter out into the kind of funny conversation you heard with Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon there is what people are sort of now thinking in that way. Whatever they're talking about, they're thinking this falls under the rubric of hashtag you name it.
So as I was saying before, hashtags have certainly become slang. So there are, you know, still the subset of people who use it to talk about things. But myself in particular, I use them to punctuate certain statements that I make. They can be very funny in nature. On Instagram, I think you see this most often, people adding, you know, 5 to 10 different hashtags. Some of that is to get their content discovered. Some of it, they're just being clever and cute in how they're using them.
I mean, pop stars picking it up, you know, Mariah Carey, her latest album, hashtag beautiful. Will.i.am, hashtag willpower. Facebook had to play some cash up here, Zach Seward.
Right. They added a hashtag as a feature several months ago, although, you know, it doesn't seem as though it's catching on in nearly the same way as it has on Facebook, on Twitter, that is. And you know, Twitter kind of owns it. As Jennifer said, you know, the concept was not original to Twitter, but at this point, the hashtag is synonymous with Twitter.
Jennifer, how do you see Twitter evolving? I mean, in a way, this is things just become more fluid. Twitter, with its short messages and real-time display, allowed people to kind of flow into one big braided conversation. Is this where the internet's going? More real-time awareness of what everybody's thinking, popping up, contributing?
I think to some extent, yes. I mean, absolutely. Your caller that was talking about search, you know, very astute. I mean, it's a very bold prediction that he made. But in some essence, you know, what you want to find is going to be, you know, and that paradigm for how you find it is going to change. And Twitter offers a new kind of paradigm for that. I don't think we're, you know, anywhere near the point where Twitter is going to usurp Google in terms of search. But in terms of finding information, it's absolutely a new avenue to do that with a little bit more context. I think, as I think you guys have already talked about, Twitter's biggest problem is figuring out, you know, what it is and what it wants to be moving forward. And it has this sort of dilemma at the moment of, you know, should it be more like Facebook? And with the introduction of inline images, you're seeing this more rich media experience, which is more familiar to the 1.19 billion people who use Facebook. But that dilemma in being more like more familiar social networks such as Facebook, it also doesn't it works well for advertising potentially, but it may not sit well with some of the earlier users of Twitter, such as myself, who, you know, really come to appreciate the platform for what it is.
But if you want to dip into the flow of what's going on, it's kind of the place to dip. Charles in Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just want to make a quick statement. I think Twitter has a perfect niche in today's society, because it seems to be pretty proportional to everyone's attention span, especially the younger people who haven't already invested so much time and effort in Facebook or older platforms for social media or for getting news content out. And so I can definitely see, especially with even though they're coming out with the IPO, I can definitely see a lot of success and a lot of toleration for, you know, being bogged down with ads and having more friction, like your previous caller said. So with that, I'll take myself off the air.
I appreciate your call, Charles. Zach, a good match with our attention spans these days. You can see a lot in a hurry and ping off to whatever interests you.
It's amazing how much information, it turns out, can be packed into 140 characters, even more so if you're writing in Japanese and the characters are that much more efficient. And that, by the way, may not be a coincidence. Twitter is very, very, very popular in Japan. What Twitter says, and CEO Dick Costolo has been talking about on its IPO roadshow, is that the 140 characters are increasingly the caption for what he says is, quote, a much bigger canvas. That canvas can include, I mean, the photos that we've just been talking about, but also videos, links to news articles, that sort of thing. So, you know, Twitter began with this notion that 140 characters and that's it. And now its question is, what more can you do with 140 characters being more of a jumping off point?
So, Jennifer, what hashtags would you drop on Twitter today?
Oh, gosh. put me on the spot. I'm still waking up, but, anything related to Real Housewives.
Hashtag Real Housewives, and we're into your interest zone. For Twitter itself, I don't know. Hot thing today, Zach, is it going to be hot thing tomorrow, next week?
It's going to have to stop being hashtag unprofitable, that's for sure.
An end to that if it really wants to make a go of it. Great to have you both with us. Jennifer Van Grove at CNET joining us from San Diego, California. Jennifer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Hashtag thank you, Jennifer. And Zach Seward at Quartz in New York City. Zach, so good to have you with us today. Thanks for all your insights on Twitter. Thank you, Zach.
My pleasure.
We'll go out with will.i.am. His song is hashtag that power from his album, of course, hashtag willpower. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'ma take it higher and higher, higher and higher. I stay in fire, tire. Keep burning like that fire. Hour, bigger.